This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Roddinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us at our favorite hangout as we talk a little politics. Lots happening this week, Brandon, as always. Let's start national and then bring in a little Texas politics because we've got a lot to talk about. Right off the top, our favorite president, Donald Trump. I know this is going to shock you, Brandon, but he's tweeted out again, this time talking due process for the fact that we don't really need due process. What
yeah,
was he saying?
He apparently implied that we may need to essentially undo the due process for people who have come to the U.S. illegally. This obviously is on the heels of weeks and even months and in some cases years of this crisis at the border. This is something obviously politically that's really powerful for Trump. But it's not clear that his term invasion is something that would justify the undoing of due process. It seems like in my reading of the way that this is handled at the border in form and function is that there are limited rights for people who are migrants to this country, legally or illegally. The due process is sort of uneven. It's also the case that like there are kind of exemptions for search and seizure rights that for people who come illegally. These are civil cases, not criminal cases, so they're not entitled to an attorney. So I guess I would label this as sort of they have modest due process, but not sort of full due process in the same way. What's your take?
Yeah, I think no one's going to mistake President Trump for a constitutional lawyer or scholar on this, right? So the law is actually pretty clear on what rights and privileges are allowed anyone trying to enter the United States. In this specific instance, it's individuals who have demonstrated what they call a credible fear or potential persecution in their home country. There's a process that needs to be followed. It's consistent with international norms and conventions. And so there's due process built in. You do not have a right to an attorney. So the rights are not consistent with what you would normally get when you're in the United States. But there is a process. And so the idea that you can't actually, you know, state your claim would be against the law, both in the United States and really internationally. So I think that I think what the president's trying to do is accelerate the process of removal. He's conflating kind of different issues here. But a lot of this comes again with what we talked about with the issues related to zero tolerance, which it turns out, Brandon, may not actually even be in effect anymore as a practical matter?
Yeah, it's interesting. I never thought that we would long for a president who is an attorney, right? People complain that there are too many attorneys in politics. And yet, you know, maybe having somebody who understands that due process requirements from the generations of case law that we have, as well as these amendments that are, you know, now fixed in the Constitution.
Or at least one to listen to his own lawyers.
Right. Yeah, just go down the hall and, you know, knock on a couple doors, right? Well, some other changes are afoot in the Trump administration, Jay. He's talked about reorganizing government. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the president has put out sort of this, or at least is in the process of putting out, a large reorganization of the federal government. The big ticket item is sort of recombining the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Education. This has been sort of a longstanding issue, particularly among conservative circles, about essentially disbanding the Department of Education. As you might recall, back in the 60s, it used to be known as the Health, Education, and Welfare Department, and that department was actually split into two. Again, in the era that we have now with the responsibilities and the different areas that both departments deal with, it seems kind of crazy to try to smash them together.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I thought you were going to make a Rick Perry, can't remember the three agencies, the two eliminate joke, but so I'll make it since it's obligatory. It's interesting. I mean, this historically is a kind of way that presidents grab power. So traditionally, it's been the case that these reorganizations take power away from independent agencies and sort of consolidate them into more executive control, especially when it comes to appointing people. Nixon used this to sort of delegitimize part of executive government, the other branches or the other agencies in government. Carter brought a reform mentality as part of a way to kind of wrestle power away from what Congress was doing and to give more centralized control to the White House. So it's not surprising that the president would want to kind of change government in a way to structure it to make it easier to cut or revamp. So this is definitely kind of in keeping with what sort of strong kind of centralized presidents do. But it is fairly radical. And when it happens, it's they tend to be fairly expensive and it tends to take quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Back in the 90s, President Clinton had famously put together this Reinventing Government Commission, headed by Vice President Gore. And the idea was essentially to sort of change up the structure of government, make it more efficient.
Yeah.
This is along that similar vein of trying to, again, reorganize government in the image that he wants. We've already seen sort of the addition of a new branch of service.
Yeah.
In the Space Force.
Maybe.
I've got to come back to the Space Force. But again, all of this sort of fits together. President Trump's trying to put his brand on the government.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears real quick, talk a little bit of international news. Before we get to Texas, there's a couple of, I think, important things that are on the horizon. The president has already sort of telegraphed John Bolton, his national security advisor, is meeting with his Russian counterpart, a potential Putin-Trump July meeting, a Russian-U.S. summit.
Yeah.
And then also we've got probably one of the most important elections that people are not talking about. And it's not in any state, but it's in the Republic of Mexico. Mexico has an election on July 1st. Huge issues, huge ramifications for the U.S.
Yeah, to me, they're both very Trump-centric, right? Especially the Putin and Trump possible meeting. The issues on the agenda are these that have been contentious between the two nations for many years, the invasion of Ukraine, support of Syrian President Bashar Assad, even the poisoning of an ex-spy in England, right, which we talked about weeks and weeks ago on the pod. These are all kind of in the kind of Trump-Putin wheelhouse, and it could be that there could be some explosions as a result of it. On the Mexican election, it's also very Trump-centric, right? A big reason that Manuel López Obrador has come back into the fold in Mexico, which has traditionally sort of pushed him away as being too kind of leftist, is that there's this reaction to Donald Trump and his policy. So I suspect, and the polls seem to suggest, that AMLO, these are his initials, is likely to win. And that may have tremendous impact on things that happen between Texas and the U.S., but also potentially NAFTA, which would affect the entire country.
Yeah, López Obrador is really, I think, what we'd call kind of a modern Mexican nationalist, probably in the same sort of vein as, I think, as President Trump. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of Mexico first versus America first, as our good friend Geronimo Cortina likes to say. So it'll be interesting to see how this all fits together. Again, you talk about NAFTA. NAFTA is hugely important to folks here in Texas and nationally. That's going to be it's in the process of getting renegotiated, but what it looks like, I think, is going to be radically different.
Yeah.
Just a lot of moving pictures here, but you're right, huge international implications that are going to affect us here in Texas and in the U.S.
Yeah.
Brandon, I want to talk about something before we get to Texas, which I think is kind of important in a broader sense, and it seems kind of trivial, but we've gotten to the point now in our politics where you can't go out to a meal without getting harassed by folks who don't agree with you.
Right.
We saw this with Sarah Huckabee Sanders was at a restaurant in Lexington, Virginia, out with her family, and was essentially told to leave.
Right.
This follows a Department of Homeland Security secretary who was harassed while she was eating at a Mexican restaurant in Washington, D.C. Congresswoman Maxine Waters is also, I think, made the argument that they should be harassed.
Right.
What's going on? Can't we just get along?
Yeah. Can't we just eat a meal in peace is, I guess, what the Trump administration is asking. I don't think that this is necessary. I mean, people have the right to their opinions, and clearly there's a lot of friction when it comes to the political scene, but I don't think that this is something that is what reasonable people do. And I think that it definitely has to end. We can't, I think, be in a position where we're able to have some kind of growth, some kind of agreement, which there's a lot of ground for, if we can't sit down and have a meal together, if we can't sort of embrace each other, even in the most basic of ways. So to me, this is problematic, and hopefully this is the end of it. But I don't know that it will be, right? Because we're seeing that there's been a tremendous amount of pushback from this restaurant, the Red Hen, which I think they should rename the Blue Hen. Get it? Blue Hen.
I like that.
But this obviously has longer legs than just this kind of one meal that, you know, that these individuals are eating. There's a bigger, I think, civic problem that we face.
Well, shifting gears, talking a little Lone Star politics. Just right off the top, the Washington Generals of Texas politics, the Texas Democratic Party, had their annual convention. Well, I shouldn't say annual, but they had a big party convention. And what do you think, Brandon? Was it a success? Are they ready to go? Is the blue wave going to wash over the state of Texas?
Yeah, it's like one of those movies, right, where like there's a giant, you know, tsunami coming. I don't know. As we've talked about before, I doubt we'll see a tremendous wave, but it's clear that they're going to be in a position to pick up a couple seats. They organize a party platform, and I wanted to ask you about this, actually. There are some things on the platform which I think generally are in the sweet spot of moderation for where Texans are. They oppose the zero tolerance policy, which may be phased out anyway. They are also looking to protect victims and hold offenders accountable in sexual harassment issues. But they also have some policies on the platform that support, you know, healthcare for all, right, which is fairly radical when it comes to the kind of current system. Also stricter gun control laws that, you know, go certainly against what a lot of Texans would probably support. So are they pushing too far to the left? And is that going to jeopardize their ability to be able to kind of pull moderates into the party?
Yeah, I mean, my sense is if you looked at this state's party platform, it would probably mirror very similar to what you're seeing in other states, particularly, you know, more traditionally blue states.
Yeah.
And I think probably what the national party is. I think what you're
the national kind of effect on the parties statewide of state level have kind of really kind of diverged that ideology.
Yeah,
right?
No, I mean, a couple of things to me that came out that I thought were interesting were both the Republican Democratic parties are now advocating for the legalization or at least a decriminalization of marijuana. That just doesn't really happen very often. You wouldn't expect that. So there seems to be real bipartisan consensus. Also, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, are now in favor of criminal justice reform as it relates to incarcerations and things like that. So I think you're seeing, I think, some positive movement, but you're right. Look, the big thing that jumped out at me, the Democratic Party platform mentions nothing about taxes.
Right.
Right. Yeah. If you look at any of the polling, it's really continues to be one of the top three issues. And so they're sort of out of step. They don't really talk about state property taxes or some of these other issues. I think financial matters that matter. They're for a $15 minimum wage, which is a good thing. But if you are a homeowner in Texas, there's nothing on that platform that gets you really fired up.
Hey, you know what? I also wanted to say one other thing that jumped out at me, and that was that apparently there's some pranking involved, Jay. Representative Briscoe Kane, who's from Houston here, Houston area in Deer Park, and one of his consultants apparently had snuck into the facility where the convention was being held and were passing out fake yard signs that read, "This home is a gun-free, safe space." And he laughed, I suppose, that people took this and were happy to have it. Is this the way that our representative should be spending their time? Yes or no?
Okay, that's really funny for Briscoe Kane to do it in a very Briscoe Kane kind of thing. He and Stickland probably worked that one out, Jonathan Stickland. But yeah,
I want to see the text chain on that. Like how they came to the point where they were going to like, you know, we're going to, you know, goading each other to do it.
Exactly, right? But I mean, it certainly is funny that they would do that. And the fact that people wouldn't necessarily realize that this was potentially inviting people to come break into their home.
Yeah, right. This is Briscoe Kane. I bet a lot of people didn't know who it was, but the people who did probably understood exactly what was happening. So, yeah.
Well, the Texas Supreme Court, Brandon, came out with a pretty significant ruling related to the bag ban down in Laredo, Texas. So Laredo had issued a ban on plastic, single-use plastic bags. It went up to the Texas Supreme Court, and it all dealt with whether the bag ban complied with the Solid Waste Act, which is which is a state law. And the court essentially ruled that it did not, and it was a huge victory, I think, for Governor Abbott and Attorney General Paxton, who've made the argument that these locally controlled laws shouldn't exist, and that you need much more of a statewide control on a lot of what we have traditionally been local control.
Yeah. They would definitely prefer that they have the whip hand, right? Because we've talked about this before. There's a lot of this kind of centralized policymaking at the state level that they'd like to keep there and not have branch out to local governments. I think you're right. I thought it was fairly interesting. The question was whether or not this bag ban that to some degree regulates the solid waste management, which is a function of the state, can be done at the local level. I guess I read this as somewhat narrow in that the court may have allowed for other types of local control to be able to exist. This will require more clever language and in ordinances at the local level and probably require then the state to kind of sharpen their approach to this in the next legislative session, which I assume they will. But I think that the period where local government is able to do a lot, especially something that may violate or run afoul of the politics of the Republicans who run the state, it is pretty much over.
Yeah, I think you're going to see more of these kinds of issues pop up all the time. This is a state government that wants to take power away from local governments, and we're just going to continue seeing more of that. Well, Brandon, we're on the sort of the precipice of a big demographic shift here in Texas. Hispanic Texans are on pace to become the largest ethnic group in Texas by 2022. Mm-hmm. That's several years before many people had thought. Big change in Texas. What does it really mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, the political implications are significant, right? If we see a burgeoning group of potentially Democratic voters, although that's still in question, then this could clearly shift the state into a different dynamic. But to me, actually, the policy implications are more interesting, right? I mean, just think about education, right? Because Latinos lag behind other racial groups when it comes to graduation rates. There are also not enough dual language teachers to be able to educate the Latinos who may not have English proficiency. It's also the case that the income of Hispanics is lower than it is for Asians or for Anglos. So there are tremendous policy implications to this demographic change, as there are for all demographic changes. But given how quickly it's come, like you said, it's come more quicker pace than we expected. The state will definitely face some major challenges on this in the next couple of years.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about the big issues of the week, and that's the Supreme Court of the United States came down with just a bunch of new rulings that have had huge effects long term. Well, Brandon, we had a big round of cases come out from the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. We knew that it's when you get close to the end of the term that there's just a treasure trove of them coming out. I'm not sure I expected, I think, the impact of these and sort of the breadth and width of some of these cases. Yeah. So we had five big cases that came out, starting off with the Supreme Court essentially has said that sales taxes can be collected when they're for online purchases. And that's now a universal thing. We know that in Texas, there was a deal with some specific vendors to get a percentage of it. Now you're going to see every state in the union want to collect sales taxes on point of sale purchases online. Huge ramifications in the retail industry. We saw that the court came out.
Buy your Amazon stuff right now.
Exactly. Cell phone warrants. For a long time, there's a question of whether or not location history could be obtained by the police without a warrant. Mm-hmm. The court has come out and said, nope, you need a special warrant just to get that. We had a big ruling when it came to the redistricting case in Texas, Abbott versus Sanchez. Essentially, what they said was that there was no racial gerrymandering involved in the state of Texas, and that the presumption of legality in the cases rests with the state, meaning that if you're going to challenge on racial grounds, you're going to have to provide the evidence directly. So the assumption is that the maps are always going to be good when they're coming out of the state. Mm-hmm. We got a big ruling on the travel ban. President Trump's travel ban is in fact constitutional. On a 5-4 decision, the majority of the court essentially ruled that regardless of the fact that he may have made some statements referring to it as a Muslim ban, it is not. It is a travel ban and continues to go on. And then I think the last ruling wasn't really referenced as much, hasn't got the level of publicity or conversation as such, but the state of California had banned what they call crisis pregnancy centers, which were essentially centers that counseled against abortion. California had stated that it was misrepresenting what it was. The Supreme Court said that's a violation of free speech, and so they are allowed to exist.
Let's talk first about the Texas redistricting case, which I think was one of the biggest, certainly for Texas, but also I think that had serious implications for what happens nationally. This was a close vote, Jay, right? 5-4. What they said, as you noted, is that basically that the state did not discriminate by drawing these maps, save for one. This was HD 90 in Tarrant County, which is a really unusual looking district. If you Google search it, you can see how unusual it is.
Right.
To me, this is a big problem for the challengers of these state voting rights. They have lost two consecutive Super Bowls, one on gerrymandering and one on voter ID. So the trend for them is not going in the right direction. It also implies that the legislative attempts to create these lines in a way that favors the current status and also potentially limits the ability to cast a ballot are going to be pretty much front and center. I was also struck by the fact that the pushback on this that really was spurred on by the Sotomayor dissent suggested that this was something which was going to have profoundly bad implications for voting rights. Whether this is true or not, it's definitely going to be the case that as a political issue, the Democrats can use this to rally behind it. They would like to have won, no doubt, but it could be that the fact that it didn't go their way allows them to sharpen their blade to be able to say, look what happens if you don't elect Democrats. So maybe this is in some ways a kind of potential for there to be a backlash, which was politically favorable.
Yeah, Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch actually in a concurring opinion essentially said that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act doesn't actually apply to redistricting. Yeah, so this whole central argument was this balance between equal protection, which says one man, one vote, everyone has an opportunity to be represented, and the idea, which inherently says that you shouldn't favor one group over the other, versus the Voting Rights Act, which essentially tries to consciously favor the interests of particular communities that have been historically discriminated against. And you have five members of the court essentially saying you can't really use race as a factor.
Wow.
And so increasingly what you're probably going to see, I think, going forward is whether or not race will continue to see voting rights style redistricting. And
yeah.
I'm not sure that you will. This might really lead to the end of districts that were drawn for the benefit of one particular ethnic community.
Yeah. No, and it, you know, it's also the case that the Supreme Court this same week kicked a case that was a North Carolina case on similar grounds. And last week we talked about they also punted on cases in Wisconsin and Maryland. So we know that the court has been very picky about how these come. And so it's going to be a longer slog to get there's some movement on that. Let's talk about sales tax, Jay. Everybody likes talking about taxes, right? But like you said, the court's ruling here opens up some potentially really interesting opportunities for revenue growth. We know the state is perpetually short on the ability to be able to grow a budget. There's some constitutional limits, there's some statutory limits, but this is in some ways kind of good news for Texas and for states that rely on proper sales taxes, because this might have the potential to generate like a lot of money for the state as well as for local governments.
Yeah, I think it's still questionable as to which end of the exchange is going to be receiving the dollars, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is it the company where you're housed, the state that you're housed, is that tax rate,
mm-hmm.
or is it where the individual resides?
Mm-hmm.
And I think those are some of the questions that are going to have to get worked out. But there's no doubt that this is a huge boon for states because their revenues were dropping dramatically. We've seen over the last few years, statewide projections in terms of taxes have gone down every cycle. You see that here even in municipal context. So it helps cities like Houston and Dallas that want to maintain strong sales tax bases. It also changes the dynamic, I think, in some cases for some towns and some suburban communities where they may not have a lot of retail businesses themselves,
yeah.
but all those online purchases may suddenly be beneficial to them. So
yeah.
if I'm living out in a town with not that many retail vendors, I suddenly have access to sales tax revenue I may never have had before.
That's right. Either the state and the local governments are going to be very careful in how they set these rates and or if they decide to cap the ability, you know, for these taxes to be collected, because it's definitely going to affect people's bottom line. And that's the kind of thing we know that in an election can be highly problematic. But I don't think any Republican or any person ever has been not elected because they lowered taxes. So it could be that the budget writers are happy because they have a bit of a cushion, but also politicians in office right now can say they lower taxes if they choose to lower taxes as a result of the fact that they're going to generate more tax revenue and therefore can kind of lower that rate overall.
Well, Brandon, the big sort of ruling came out just a day ago. Was on the travel ban.
Yeah,
and it's been one of the most widely discussed issues since the beginning of the Trump presidency. And this was a ban against people from specific countries coming to the United States. This is the third iteration of the travel ban.
Yeah.
Previous ones had been ruled unconstitutional. This one added, I think, North Korea, ironically, into
yeah.
the mix, who is now apparently one of our fast friends.
We're good friends.
Yeah, but I think the larger implication here is that the president, it reinforces the idea that the president's plenary powers as it relates to immigration still holds.
Yeah.
His ability to essentially dictate in some ways, not so much how the issues are once you get to the border, but just simply whether you can come,
yeah.
I think still hold as long as it's consistent with the Immigration and Nationality Act. And that this is, I think, has long-term implications. Prior statements made as it relates to intent don't necessarily cloud or undermine the fundamental policy if the policy itself is constitutional.
That to me is really interesting, right? There's no sanction for acting and speaking in a way that might be considered problematic for your future legal case. So I think that's really interesting for this president in particular, but all presidents in general. To me, it suggests perhaps there's a kind of future emboldening for Donald Trump. And we've seen this to some degree in the last couple of weeks with the border security issue and some of the family separation issues. I don't know that there's going to be a way to be able to challenge the president in any direct way, right? He's suggested that he's going to tweak how that process works. The courts have largely agreed with him in broad terms. So it's going to be difficult, I think, for opponents to be able to say that this is something which is wrong and use the courts as a way to be able to stop him.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you why all these cases matter and kind of what the politics behind some of it is and what the implications might possibly be.
So, Jay, we don't often use the term blockbuster and Supreme Court in the same sentence, but we had a pretty big week for the court. Lots of interesting cases, big implications for the nation and for Texas. What was your take on what was happening and why do we care?
Well, I think this is important because I think it might fundamentally change sort of the politics around the court itself.
Mm.
For years, Republicans have used the Supreme Court as a rallying cry to motivate their base to come out and vote. This has been sort of the singular thing. We need to control the court. A lot of that was tied into social issues. Now I think sort of the worm has turned a bit. And I think this is going to be a rallying cry for Democrats. The politics around what happened with Merrick Garland not getting appointed, Neil Gorsuch ultimately becoming confirmed, that changed the court and kind of reinforced a lot of these rulings, many of these rulings liberals are not happy about. So I think you're going to see an energized Democratic Party around the Supreme Court, something you probably haven't seen in the past.
Yeah, we don't often see elections fought about courts, but this is, I think, central to so much of what the Trump administration has been able to do. The court has been moving in a more conservative direction, I think there's no doubt. It's still split. A lot of these decisions are 5-4 decisions, as you noted. So it's definitely the case that if one or two justices moves in a particular direction, then you could see the court essentially certifying one wing of that ideology or the other. So, for instance, people talked about Kennedy possibly retiring or Breyer. If that happens and they're replaced by conservatives, they're likely to be, then we're going to see, I think, a real movement there. It also suggests that the lower courts, although they've really had a mixed bag in terms of pushing back on the Trump administration, are really less relevant than the Supreme Court as the ultimate decider. So it's a high-risk strategy for the Trump administration, but ultimately it seems in some of these cases like it's paying off. I think it's also the case that it's interesting to suggest that the court has been less willing to knock down legislative action or challenge the president on their action. So the Texas case suggests that, as well as the travel ban case. The court is willing to allow for the politics and legislative and executive process to work itself out, and the court will only intermediately intervene. But for Texas, there's profound implications here, right? We're talking about potentially billions of dollars in sales tax revenue, depending on how it gets all sorted out, as well as the fact that voting rights are at stake here with the gerrymandering case. So you have to assume that the way that the court or the legislature draws these lines is not discriminatory. It's not intended to do that. And that's going to be a hard hurdle for those who object.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci. Special kudos to our web team, Giselle Bueno, Matt Prendergast, and to our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, the Chief Justice of our Supreme Court, Todd Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.